This is The Illusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, burn language to a crisp. Coming up in today's show, food! How do you put food into words so that some stranger can read the words and make the food? Good recipe writing can be invisible work. What are the verbal ingredients of a well-written recipe? On with the show.
Yeah, it was very nerve-wracking because people spend money on ingredients. They may be cooking it for a special occasion. They're trying to impress a date or whatever. There's a lot that can go wrong with food, and it's quite a weighty responsibility to, you know, be responsible for someone's dinner or their birthday cake or whatever. It's a big deal.
So if it's a cookbook for families, you're going to write it differently than if it's a cookbook for expert bakers and figuring out how to get the recipe that's right for that.
Yeah, it's very different from cooking in real life, I think, which is weird because you're trying to tell people how to cook the dish.
It'd be really easy to show you, but it's hard to describe in language.
Yeah, it's a complete nightmare. There's so much that you do and you assume that people will understand what you're saying. My name's Mimi A, and I am the author of two cookery books. The first one is called Noodle, 100 Great Recipes, and the second one is called Mandalay. Even things like cover with a lid, rather than just saying cover, you have to say with a lid.
Rather than like a sweater,
yes,
or a hat.
Yes, I know. Even things like measurements. So one of the things I do, I think a lot of cooks do, is they say a dash of this and a spoonful of that and a glug of this. And then you get people saying, no, you have to say what mil it is or what grammage it is. And you kind of go, oh, I've never weighed this before. I just know it because that's what it is. So, yeah, that was difficult. I think one of my recipes, one of the ingredients is a third of a banana, and my editor came back to me and went, how much does that weigh? And I kind of went, I don't know how much a third of a banana weighs.
How big's a banana?
And the thing is, I know it's a reasonable question. It is a reasonable question. But the thing is, I've never weighed it because it always seems to have worked. It's always a third. It doesn't matter what size the banana is. So
I suppose even a massive banana or a moderate to small banana, once you've only got a third of it, the distinction between a third of massive and a third of small is not so huge.
Yeah.
And people complain about how things are written too. You know, they complain about the language you use to describe things because it doesn't make sense to them. And then we know we have to write it differently in order to clearly explain the process.
This is Rachel Greenhouse, a cookbook editor for America's Test Kitchen. When the staff cooks concoct recipes, it's Rachel's job to ensure that they're written in a way that means they are comprehensible to the cookbook user at home. There's no room for misunderstanding in a recipe, or your pie might explode, or your soup could give everyone the runs.
Our recipes, all of the actual, you know, here's how much of this to use and what to do with it, come from trained cooks. And then it comes to me for editing to make sure it sounds right. There are certain ways we have to talk about certain things because you always want to describe this particular action the exact same way across all recipes, across all books. And that is prescriptive. What is not is everything around it. So we have, you have head notes, what we call the why this recipe works. That's like a little essay that tells you what you're going to do and why and how we got to the point.
And it might make you interested in trying that particular recipe, as well as telling you what you might serve it with or how you could modify it with extra spices or a different cut of meat. Rachel also has to tweak those head notes if the recipe has adapted from, say, an older recipe where the language needs updating or if the recipe previously appeared in a different context.
So if originally it was written for a magazine where they had three pages to talk about yeast, and here I only have a paragraph, it's deciding what's the most important thing to say. And if someone's only going to read what's on this page, will they be able to make this dish exactly like they need to in order to succeed? So my job is framing, contextualizing, translating from professional cook, trained cook to home cook, and sometimes even to people who can't cook, who are trying to learn. Because people who have gone through culinary school, have cooked in restaurants, don't always know what people don't know.
That's the thing when you're writing a recipe. How much knowledge and expertise can you assume that the cook has?
Unless you're writing kind of Noma by René Redzepi, the assumption is that it'll be someone coming in cold who doesn't necessarily have any experience at all. And so you need to be able to give, it's a set of instructions, isn't it? I mean, you want them to be able to follow it and be able to do it from start to finish.
Because we're making so many assumptions. They're just like secret assumptions about what people at home are doing and how they're doing it. You know, that you have an oven, that you have a stove, that you have refrigeration, that you know what tool to use when I say stir, you know what tool to use when I say whisk, you know what tool to use when I say scrape.
Combine would be a word I see quite a lot, but if you didn't know what you were doing, that could have so many different applications.
That's one I never even thought about, and I use it all the time. There are so many different ways you could do that. And if I just use the word, I guess I'm assuming you're doing it the way I mean you to, but...
In a cement mixer.
Yes, with a birch broom or something.
I've noticed in my cookery book collection, which spans many decades, books from the past 20 years or so tend to tell you exactly what to do in each step. Like, take the pastry out of your fridge for 5 minutes, then sprinkle your clean and dry work surface and clean and dry rolling pin with flour until they are finely but consistently covered, and roll out the pastry to the thickness of a pound coin whilst chanting, "I'm the king of pastry! I'm the king of pastry!" But go back to the 1980s or further, and they might not tell you that you need to flour the surface before rolling out pastry. First, make your pastry, idiot. Then line your pie dish with it and make a lattice for the top. Use your head, do I have to tell you everything? And in some recipes from a few hundred years before that, the instructions just say something like, first make a life-size pastry deer. How? Then fill it with wine. How? Then shoot it with an arrow so it looks like it's bleeding. Why? And also how?
I do think it's important with recipes to be very, very clear and not to make any assumptions, because you don't know who you're talking to, and you don't know even if they know how to make pastry.
Let alone a pastry deer. Felicity Cloak is the author of 5 cookbooks, and she writes the How to Make the Perfect column in The Guardian, where she tries out several different cookery writers' versions of a recipe of, say, profiteroles or spanakopita or vindaloo, to work out how to make the best version. So she not only writes recipes, she reads a lot of different ones too.
You never stop learning, so you can never put too much detail in a recipe, in my opinion. I think I find it quite easy just because I've never had any formal cookery training. And initially, I thought that was a great disadvantage. And now I think it's a great boon. Because, okay, my pastry definitely is not as good as Delia's, but it does mean that I know how to explain things because I have learnt them myself as well.
And so a lot of my job is making sure everything's spelled out enough people can successfully cook from it, but not so much that someone's going to look at it and be like, do you think I'm an idiot? Because you don't want to condescend either. And people are very touchy about that stuff, I found. Because they also, cooking is this weird sort of intimate space where people have very strong feelings about, even if they don't think of themselves as cooks, if you do it every day and someone comes in and tries to spell things out to you, there's a weird dynamic there of like, you're not an expert, but you're
competent.
You're competent, or you're a regular, even if you've never studied or never even had like a home ec class. And it's something that people learn in a very intimate way, often too, with their learning from family members, learning, you know, at grandma's apron strings or something. So you have to be just the right balance.
Right. So just from the words on the page, ensure that someone, anyone, could correctly turn out the dish without having to go so far as to tell them which kitchen drawer to find the rolling pin in. Then there are numerous other constraints that a recipe writer might be under.
So we've been doing healthier books lately, where the sodium count can't be over a certain level, or the fat count, or you can't use certain ingredients. I just did a book on the food processor. It was like how to use your food processor more in the kitchen. And every part of the recipe, if it was a recipe that someone just was like, well, let's make a cake and we'll make it using the food processor. And then every step of the recipe, you have to think, I could do this by hand, or should I do it in the food processor? And so that the way you write the recipe and the ingredients you choose to use, all the decisions lead back to how can we most emphasize the food processor rather than what would make this cake actually platonically the best cake. So if it's more interesting to chop nuts in the food processor than it is to just add some almond extract, it would be a cake with almonds in it rather than a cake with almond extract, because then you're showing more about how the tool works.
Wow.
Sometimes it's literal constraints of a published book. So you only have 10 lines to list the ingredients, so you can't do more than 10 ingredients.
Why?
Because that's how printing works. If you're trying to fit a recipe on every page, then you have to have a photo, because everyone has to have photos now, and you know that the recipe is a certain length. All of our designers are in-house. They'll show us a mock-up of what a page looks like. You count the lines.
So no 20-ingredient spice blends for you, sunshine. Although the recipe's ingredients and steps are not always dictated by the room on the page, Mimi A was given a lot more freedom in her books.
Actually, quite a lot of the salad recipes is literally just mix all the ingredients together. So it's like one sentence. So yeah, that's my kind of recipe. Some of the recipes are just one sentence. Some goes on for like four pages.
Is there some fear when you're writing a recipe and it's four pages that someone will get to that bit of the book and just look at it and go, oh no, I can't do this. Just the size of it looks overwhelming.
Yeah, I've tried very, very hard not to do that. The only times I've done that is where there literally are that many stages, but it's worth it. And I've tried to say that. I think one of my recipes I've said, this is a massive faff. I think I really have. That's literally what I've said about it. So.
I think I would find that reassuring, though, that I wasn't doing it wrong if it was a massive faff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or that if you think it's a massive faff, it must be worth it in the end.
Yeah. I've tried to be honest with everything. Like one of my other recipes says, this will make your house stink for about 2 days. So, you know, because I don't want people to fall into the trap of going, oh, I'll make this recipe and then, oh my God, what's happened? So...
I like that. It's sort of anti-aspirational.
Managing expectations. That's what it's about.
That is very thoughtful.
I'll try.
When I'm writing about food, I do try and describe more than just the taste and the appearance because, you know, it is when you're eating something, even if you don't realise it, is a big part of it. And I try to make it simple for the home cook like me, who maybe doesn't have a, you know, an instant probe thermometer or whatever, to look at something or touch it, give it a poke, and see how it's done, because that's so important. I don't like to trust recipes absolutely. You should also use your eyes and your ears. Ears important, for example, if you're trying to see if a pan is hot enough to cook something, that sizzle. But all your senses are very, very useful, and I think sometimes they're neglected by more traditional cookery writers.
You give a range of times for doneness. You give a visual, not just visual, all kinds of sensual cues. So it's about the smell. It's about the way something feels when you touch it. It's about how it looks.
Those visual cues, you have to choose carefully too. But saying something like, roll out the pastry to the thickness of a pound coin, is no use to the cook in a territory that does not use pound coins, or instructing someone unfamiliar with American small change to squeeze out a dime-sized blob of something. I get why the instruction, fry until golden brown, comes up a lot. Although fry until Pantone shade number 15-0953 would be more objective.
It does require a little bit of head scratching to think how the clearest way to depict something is. And knowing how to describe things accurately. And sometimes it can involve a little bit of creativity, thinking, what does that really look like to you? That's obviously a commonly recognised phenomenon.
You kind of try and draw comparisons so that people understand the familiar. And then when I'm trying to describe what something should look like, I'll say it should look like a cigar or it should look like a ping pong ball, you know?
If you read a lot of recipes, they have certain stock phrases. And it's not that those phrases are wrong. For example, they'll tell you to rub butter into flour until it resembles coarse breadcrumbs. It's not that that's wrong, but we've all read it so many times that you actually sort of stop thinking about it. I thought about it the other day and I thought, this doesn't really look like coarse breadcrumbs to me. It looks more like damp sand. And actually, if you actually make people look at it anew, they start thinking about what they're doing and they pay a little bit more attention.
It's not just visual comparisons that are useful when writing recipes. Mimi A's new book, Mandalay, is a Burmese cookery book. And she has to anticipate it being read and used by people that are not necessarily familiar with Burma or its ingredients and flavours. So she might refer to other countries' food to give the gist.
So you have to say, oh, look, these are our neighbours. We've got India, Thailand, China. We've got influences from them. You can say it's a bit like Malaysia as well in terms of it's not just noodles, it's not just rice, it's, you know, all sorts of whatever we have.
It's not always the best tactic, though, to use a comparison to something else, as Rachel Greenhouse has encountered.
Someone wrote into, I think, one of the magazines saying, my girlfriend is vegan, but I love cooking with bacon fat. What can I cook with that will taste similar? And they went through all of these tests to try and come up with something that would be smoky and sweet and fat and rich. They came up with this, like, very complex 8-ingredient mixture of coconut oil and smoked paprika and turbinado sugar and all of these things mixed in together, and you had to melt it and you had to clarify it and then you could use it. And at the end, they were just like, but it doesn't taste like bacon.
It's like you couldn't make bacon taste like a cucumber.
Mm-hmm. But a lot of, when you come around to a lot of vegan cooking, they're describing it in terms of non-vegan foods. So when I'm writing, I try and avoid saying, this tastes just like chicken, this tastes like tuna salad, even though it's made of chickpeas, you know.
But without comparison to other foods, it can be quite difficult to encapsulate flavour in words, as it's subjective and it's a sensory experience, not an easily verbalised one. And it can be challenging to successfully convey to the reader that the recipe will be appetising. Saying something is delicious doesn't necessarily convince that it is delicious.
Something that differs between a sort of corporate authorship, like we've got at Test Kitchen, I'm not writing as me, versus like a blogger who writes a cookbook of stuff they've cooked in their kitchen because they love it and their kids love it and it's delectable and nummy and all of those words that they like to use. But I would never use those words because we're trying to come from a more objective point of view, and the words we tend to use are perfect or foolproof or ultimate or...
Those are real grandstanding words. Ultimate, yes. That is game over.
Yeah, well...
Perfect. Building something very difficult for yourself.
But it tends towards, not that those are objective terms, but more towards like things I could somehow offer objective proof towards. Like, if you didn't do it this way, it would be worse because of this scientific reaction. Rather than, if you didn't do it this way, you might like it better because your tastes are different.
Words like nummy are very difficult for me to stomach. But I do think a lot of us find it hard to verbalize something being delicious. How do we express more the sensual experience of food?
That's exactly what you would do. You talk about actual effects on the senses rather than going into the colorful or the poetic. So you talk about texture, you talk about combinations, you talk about, you know, there are six tastes. So you talk about balance of acidic and sweet, you talk about umami, you talk about where things in the past have failed, and here's what we did differently. And you don't, I think we sometimes say delicious, but that's about as far as you go. Because
too subjective.
It's too subjective, and it's also imprecise. And so we get from this sort of scientific perspective of things that have been browned or caramelized taste good. Why do they taste good? It's because when the proteins reach a certain point, they break down and recombine to form new flavor compounds, and they hit certain receptors on your tongue in a particular way, and also, you know, in your nose as you're breathing it in. Why does hot food taste better than cold food? It's because of the way that your taste buds react to the excitation in the molecule.
Molecules and receptors are very appetizing terms. I've noticed that a lot of the recipe writers that make me hungry are not doing that by telling me the food tastes good. They talk about how that dish might fit a particular mood or circumstance. For instance, Mimi A accompanies each of her recipes with an introduction about the emotion or history or anecdote that goes with that dish.
Because I'm talking about where I'd eat this and how I'd eat this and who I'd be eating it with, hopefully I'm putting a picture into that person's head, the person reading it, where they go, oh, I'd like some of that.
God, I really fancy that for dinner, which is half the battle with the recipes, that you want to make them.
And the other half of the battle with the recipes is optimising the likelihood of that dinner turning out well.
I think people have a very intimate and complicated relationship with cooking, and being good at cooking or being bad at cooking or not being able to cook for yourself or failing in the kitchen are things that carry a lot of weight for a lot of people. And being able to use language to communicate to people how to do something both so, you know, visceral, you know, feeding yourself and surviving, but also so creative. You know, you can get a lot of pride from it, a lot of creative satisfaction, both for yourself and then also for anyone you're cooking for. It can bring people together. And so helping people to do that better and not fail quite so often, and feel more confident about it is very gratifying.
Rachel Greenhouse was, at time of recording, a cookbook editor for America's Test Kitchen. She just got a new job. Congratulations, Rachel. Felicity Cloak writes the Guardian column, How to Cook the Perfect. It's an invaluable resource. I always check it when I'm trying to cook something I haven't made before. As well as 5 cookbooks, she is the author of One More Croissant for the Road, a very fun memoir about when Felicity cycled more than 2,000 kilometres around France in search of the best version of the greatest French foodstuffs. Mimi A is the author of 2 cookbooks, Noodle and Mandalay, out now, and I want to eat everything in them. And coming up in today's Mini Illusionist, Mimi and Rachel consider whether a number of the difficulties in recipe writing could be overcome by using visuals.
I don't really read cookery books. I just look at the pictures. I'm a terrible, terrible person. It doesn't mean I don't buy the books. I buy so many of them, but I don't tend to read them, and that's terrible, I know. I just look at the pictures and stroke the covers.
There's this other question of the book as art object. And so do those photos that you present have to all be practical demonstrations of procedure, people using them in order to cook? And you have to show the steps that are hardest, and you have to show them exactly how you do them. Or are they using the photos just as beautiful things to look at, and then they can be sort of artistically thrown together, and they're a little more, you know, inspirational rather than technical?
So it's like, is it to stimulate your appetite mm-hmm. and desire, or is it instructional?
Yeah, so you've got also the question of like beautiful finished food photographs, like what it looks like on your table, on your dish, when everything's put together in your beautiful marble kitchen, or are these step-by-step instructions on how to make something, and what's the interaction visually between those two different kinds of photos? And then do you have to explain what's happening in the photo, or are they readable on their own? Like, how does the language interact with the photo?
Even though obviously a lot of the text is kind of blow by blow, this is how you boil an egg, you've only got the finished shot most of the time. I think a couple of ones for the salads, just because the different ingredients laid out were quite attractive. And actually, for some of the recipes, because they are, for want of a better word, when they cook down, some of the vegetables kind of look like sludge. What we've done, we've tried to put the kind of raw ingredient around the side so you know what it looked like before, because invariably it was actually more attractive when it was raw. So and one of the recipes is for, I suppose it's our Burmese equivalent of miso. And so obviously that would just be a bowl of black sludge. So what we've done there is that there's the bowl of this paste, and then the beans that we used in their untainted state all around it.
Maybe it is better just to have the words so you don't have to see the sludge.
They've done a good job of making it look attractive, actually. Glamorous sludge, I think, was the term we used.
But the problem is people are just used to beautiful photos now, and are used to tons of photos and video. Although, you know what? I've heard anecdotally and seen a little bit of evidence from like sales sides, no one wants an ebook cookbook.
Well, I don't want to use...
You don't want to use a device in the kitchen.
I really don't. Mm-hmm. Or use my dirty cooking hands on mm-hmm. it.
Yeah. There's no way around that sort of practical aspect of it, but just it makes so much sense. Every recipe could have a little embedded video clip. And everyone says they go to the internet for recipes anyway. And unless they're my mother, I don't think they're printing all of those recipes out.
Printing every frame of the video.
Yes. So there's this tension between how people want to get their cooking information.
That old adage, a picture's worth a thousand words, might be apt, though, when it comes to Mimi trying to explain how to make belt noodles.
Saying things like, oh, you know, you have to roll it into this shape, and then you have to pull up the ends together and get them to stick together. Whereas this would be just one swift action on YouTube that I could show you. So there's only so much you can do with words, because you want to show some going, look at me flipping this thing like a skipping rope, you know, so.
I hate to admit to words limitations.
Yeah.
But they have them.
Yeah.
Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is brickhole, noun, a medieval catapult for hurling stones, the rebound of a ball from the wall of a real tennis court, a similar stroke in billiards, a rebound. Try using it in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman, with help from Martin Austwick, who also makes the music you hear in the show. Hear his songs at palebirdmusic.com. On Twitter, Facebook and Instagram, you can find me at Allusionist Show. And every episode of The Allusionist, transcripts, extra information about every topic, the full dictionary entry for the randomly selected words, and live event listings, all live at the show's forever home, theallusionist.org.